Do you believe in God? And does your belief help you in your daily life? Does it help you to live a moral life? Or do you not believe in God? And if so, where do you turn for the guidance or the impulse to live a moral life? These questions have been more energetically debated over the last few years, probably owing globally to the West's confrontation with radical Islam, and here in the U.S. to the political emergence and activism of evangelical Christians, all brought to a head with the actions of George W. Bush, whether from rushing back to D.C. for Terry Schiavo or invading Baghdad. And then on the other side, we've seen the atheists respond, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, etc. Today's guest, Robert Wright, takes on big questions, and he's taken this one on with a very different perspective in a new book titled The Evolution of God. Robert Wright has written for The Sciences Magazine, Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine. He's been an editor at The New Republic, at Time, and at Slate. He's a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also founder and editor of two websites, meaningoflife.tv and bloggingheads.tv. His books include Three Scientists and Their Gods, Looking for Meaning in an Age of Information, The Moral Animal, Evolutionary Psychology and Everyday Life, Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny, and then his newest, The Evolution of God. Welcome.
Thanks. Robert Wright. To be here.
Yeah, it's really nice to see you again. I like listeners to get to know a bit about the guests, about the themselves personally, in addition to the work and the ideas that we might talk about. So let me start off with a couple of questions. What leads you, has led you to write about such big questions, and how did that sort of happen? I mean, does it go back to you as a child, you in college, you once a journalist?
That's a good question. You mean big questions in general, not just ones in this book.
Right. In other words, moral animals big. Three Scientists and Their Gods, which was the first place I found you, pretty big stuff.
I don't know, maybe a grandiose self-conception or something could be that. As for the big kind of spiritual and religious questions, I think it has something to do with the fact that I was brought up religiously. I was brought up a Southern Baptist. And that's very intense experience. You know, I remember being, responding to the altar call at about age 8 and going to the front of the church, which means you've decided to accept Christ as your Savior. You get baptized later.
Can I cut in on that?
Sure.
Because I read that in the book. When someone does that at 8 or 9, do they think that they're able to make that sort of decision at that point? And what did the church or your parents think?
That's very funny, because my parents weren't there. It was some kind of evening service. I think it was in the middle of, I think there was an evangelist visiting the church. It was not the minister, and he got us fired up. His name was Homer Martinez in El Paso, Texas. And I remember hearing later that when my parents were told I had done it, they were concerned that I wasn't old enough to make the decision wisely. And my parents were both very religious. I mean, my mother in particular, quite devout.
Within that church, yeah.
Yeah. Southern Baptist. Yeah. So it's not as if they thought it was not the right decision, but they wanted it to be a considered decision. And anyway, the commitment did not last. I did not remain a Christian. I do, unlike the kind of new atheists, I do think there is some larger purpose at work, in the universe, but I don't have a very clear conception of a God. I don't buy into any of the claims of special revelation in any of the religions.
Mm-hmm.
Although I talk about them a lot in the book, but I don't, I'm just trying to figure it out for myself.
Right. But then going back to the big questions, because your first big questions, although Three Scientists and Their Gods was about God, moral animal, it comes in, but it's not what essentially the subject, non-zero the same. But, I mean, I'm not just the only one. When I tell people, oh, I'm interviewing Bob Wright, they go, oh, big questions. You know what I mean?
It's like, no, that's your thing. I really don't
know
what it
is. A lot of people spend a lot
of
time on daily gossip.
I remember in 7th or 8th grade, when I was in San Francisco at that point, going to junior high, and we were all supposed to do a report on something, and then we were supposed to take the class to a field trip that would illustrate the something. And I remember where I took them was to the Levi Strauss factory in San Francisco, but I remember the subject – I said that that was illustrative of was industry. Okay, I did a report on, like, industry. Now, that's kind of lacking in focus when you think about it. I mean, industry is a big subject. So I don't know. It's been like that all along, apparently.
And let me ask you another one before we get into more of the topics of the book, and that is that I recall I interviewed you the first time in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I remember you, after the interview, saying, you know, you could probably put these things up on audible.com. And this was at a time before podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was probably the closest sort of thing to a podcast,
uh-huh.
right? Now, as I mentioned, you've got these two websites, meaningoflife.tv and bloggingheads.tv, which is the really active one. Talk a little about them so that people become aware of them, but also what has driven you to those, to that kind of activity?
It's funny. You know, my last book, Non-Zero, got into the information revolution that was unfolding at that point. The book came out in 2000. So the internet was a real thing by then, but a lot of stuff that's now in full bloom was just starting to happen. I compared it to the printing press in terms of the social effects, the way it would in some ways decentralize power and give new people access to channels of communication. And so I started thinking about how, and I made the argument there that video was going to become a much less centralized medium, the way print had with the printing press. And so I decided to experiment, and I got a small grant to start meaningoflife.tv, which consisted of me interviewing people.
Right.
And then we put those interviews up. And then the same, like...
Let me just tell people.
Sure.
On this meaningoflife.tv, which you told me before I went on the air is not as active, but has...
It's essentially archival, but there are some really good people on
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really good people, and it is these, quote, big questions, mostly about the meaning of life.
And it's me looking young, which I like.
Okay, good. It's got that going for it,
which is no longer true, but it was good.
And then Blogging Heads TV.
And then Blogging Heads TV. So the same tech guy, Greg Dingell, who now works at Facebook, who had helped me develop a Meaning of Life TV, helped me create... what is really, it was the first split screen video website, so far as I know. And we figured out a way to do it. It's actually not kind of capturing video conference the way you might think, because that leads to lower quality for reasons I won't bore you with. But we came up with a system for, so that any two people anywhere pretty much, as long as they had a phone connection and could eventually find a place to upload a file, could have a dialogue. And so that's turned into it's actually a company, although I must say increasingly I'm finding that philanthropic support is what makes most sense if you don't want to be kind of corrupted by the quest for enough traffic to make it on ad revenue alone. But it's a going concern. We're on the New York Times 3 times a week. They excerpt a clip 3 times a week.
Who would people find there?
A lot of people, and you know, people on the left and the right. I mean, I'm on the left, but one thing I discovered is, well, first of all, if there's not some degree of disagreement, it's not interesting to people. Secondly, disagreement genuinely does illuminate the issue. I mean, you see both sides
of
an issue. It can. It does not always. The way it's done on, like, you know, Crossfire, it may not. But if you're not kind of forcing fireworks and just letting people be honest about what they believe, and they're not trying to be contentious, it can be illuminating to see both sides of an issue. So, you know, everyone from, you know, on the left, you know, Eric Alterman, Mike Kinsley, Arianna Huffington has been on. And then on the right, you know, David Frum, and some people that I don't tend to agree with. But, you know, the upshot of that is that we have a fairly ideologically diverse comment section, which is an unusual thing on the web, because what the web naturally does is create preaching to the choir sites. And that's fine for building the base. But
and the choir replies.
And the choir replies. And that's
just as they did in church.
Yeah, it is. There's a reason they call it. Yeah, it's a call and response. And that's good. You know, mobilizing the base can be good. But if you want to do outreach, you know, if you want to get some uncommitted people and convince them that maybe your views have some merit, there's some value in having an ideologically diverse community. I know right after the Iraq War, I made a point of getting some conservatives on who had opposed the war, so the conservatives watching could see that you can be a conservative in a lot of ways without being a hawk.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we mean before the start of the Iraq War.
Yeah. I had opposed, but
right. I mean the end we have yet to see. How long are they're usually a conversation, right?
Yeah.
And how long are they usually?
Well, you know, people do it for free. We don't pay them, so I can't get too authoritarian about it. I like them to have a good time, and they usually do because it's something they don't do on TV normal. In kind of regular media, you're not allowed to have an unmediated conversation with a peer, with a colleague. So they enjoy it, and I like them to enjoy it. So I don't impose a strict time limit. We tell them 30 minutes is fine. Try not to go over an hour.
Wow.
Make it accessible in the form of topics. I mean, the whole thing is there, unedited, but you also have topic-level access. So each one has, you know, you'll have 5, 6, 7-minute things on the site. If you go to the site, bloggingheads.tv, you'll see that it's accessible at a more fine-grained mm-hmm. level, because most people don't want to sit there
So the role of editor really, really involves some work.
Yeah, except that we don't edit in the sense of cutting anything out. We leave it all.
Editing by cataloging, sort of.
That's right.
Right. By issue and
that's
so on.
Right. And yeah. It does take work.
Okay. So let's move now into the book, The Evolution of God. And what I'd like to do is start with that, you know, that staple of questions, which is, why did you write this book? And I see sort of an evolution. You wrote a book about God. Yeah. How long ago was Three Scientists and a Guide? Is that 20 years?
Was 1988.
Yeah.
That was my first book.
21 years.
Yeah.
And then Moral Animal Non-Zero, dealing with questions of morality, questions of purpose, mm-hmm. those sorts of things, questions of who we are as human beings. But now this one, again, back to God in the title. Why did you write this one?
I guess I had it vaguely in mind for a long time. I know I'd been interested in the relations among the world's religions well before 9/11, and how they were going to work things out, and how they were going to modernize and try to stay compatible with the scientific worldview and all that. You know, after 9/11, the question acquired a new urgency, the question of how particularly the Abrahamic religions, you know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, were going to reconcile themselves with one another. So what I did in the book is I wanted to know, you know, how do you bring out the best in a religion, you know? I mean, my conviction is, I mean, first of all, here's one thing I'm trying to convey in the book is, if you ask, is Islam or anything else a religion of peace, or is it a religion of war? It's just a dumb question. Sorry. I don't want to offend anybody. But it's just, all religions have their ups and downs, and their good moments and their bad moments. And in the scriptures of all of them, you see belligerent passages and you see tolerant passages. And what I wanted to do as a way of finding out what brings out the best and the worst in a religion is go back and look at what circumstances gave rise to those two kinds of scriptures. Okay, so what was going on the ground when in the book of Deuteronomy God advises the Israelites to annihilate all nearby people who don't worship him? Okay. And what's going on in other parts of the Hebrew Bible when the Israelites say to a neighbor, hey, you've got your God, we've got our God, can't we get along? You see the exact same kind of variation in all the Abrahamic scriptures, and I wanted to know how do you account for the difference? And with the hope that would tell us something about what circumstances bring out the best and worst in a religion today. So that's the basic mission.
Okay. And it's interesting. My next question was going to be, what brings out the best and worst in religions? And let me throw out what it seems to me I gleaned from the mm-hmm. book, which is that religion, like so much else, has to, especially something that's organizational, mm-hmm. Has something to do with building constituencies, mm-hmm. Survival, expansion, mm-hmm. and so the political and economic and cultural circumstances of the moment have an awful lot to do.
Right. I mean, one thing I want to convey is that to a large extent, the mood of a religion is a function of the facts on the ground, the material, political, economic facts. In that sense, you know, it's a little Marxist, not in the sense of anticipating the triumph of communism, but in the sense of seeing a material basis for a lot of what happens in the world of culture and ideas. This is a more important issue than I think people realize ideologically, because on the right in particular, you hear the idea that, you know, religions have this eternal character. Islam is a religion of violence. There's no point in making concessions or addressing grievances. You know, this is what you hear on the right, and it's a consequence of viewing religion as this kind of autonomous thing that's
unchanging.
Unchanging, has an intrinsic and essential character, impervious to changes in the material world. So, and I mean, to get a little tangential, one thing I object to about some of the so-called new atheists, not all of them consider themselves on the right, but I think when they talk as if religion is like this intrinsically bad thing, they're giving aid and comfort to the right.
It sounds like that's sort of a bank shot. In other words, it's not a direct result, but it's because they're holding up.
I mean, some of them are kind of, I mean, Chris Hitchens did favor the invasion of Russia.
He sure did.
He is on some issues in the right in foreign policy, and he does talk as if religions just have this eternal character. Sam Harris may not consider himself on the right. He sometimes talks that way. I mean, he has written that there's no point in looking for the root causes of terrorism because it flows from religion and so on. So, but anyway, I'm very much against this idea. I'm very much for the idea that, that it clearly President Obama buys into, judging by the speech he gave in Cairo, that you can change relations among religions. You can change the mood of a religion by addressing issues on the ground.
Right. You know, I interviewed Reza Aslan recently on his book, Cosmic War, How to Win a Cosmic War. And it was interesting, as I was reading your book and more what you take from, you know, a lot of it is is looking at the scriptures and the divergences and so on. But the message, his final message is, you cannot win a cosmic war. Don't engage in one. Address the grievances of the people that are fueling what then gets intermingled with this cosmic war. And by that he meant a war of religions, a war that he says is ultimately unwinnable because it's good against evil.
Right.
But if you can get down to the actual grievances, you can make progress.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, and that's what I found in ancient times as well as now in a certain sense. I mean, the basic pattern I found, to put it in like non-technical language, not that I ever get especially technical, but I do use a little game theory, kind of zero-sum, non-zero-sum.
Yes, we're going to talk about that next.
Yeah, without getting into that, I would say that when a group of people believes that they can gain through peaceful interaction with another group of people, that just brings out the tolerance in them. It brings out the tolerance of the people's culture, of the people's religion, whatever. I mean, you just think of it yourself. If on the one hand you're competing, imagine in one case you're competing with somebody for a job or a mate or something, and the way you tend to evaluate them, okay, that's like a zero-sum game. One of you is going to win, one of you is going to lose. And the way you tend to evaluate them is not very favorably, right? You're looking for flaws in them, right? I mean, that's the way rivalry and competition works. Whereas if you look at somebody and it's like, oh, we can do this deal, we can work together on this, you want to find reasons to like them. You want to judge them tolerantly. And I think that's the basic dynamic that brings out the worst and the best in a religion. And I found it in all three scriptures, looking at what gave rise to the best and worst in the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, and the Quran.
What you seem to do is, you go, here's a passage, a time when the religion was, you know, very intolerant, want to kill infidels. Here's another time when it, you know, wasn't so much. And what you then look at what was going on politically, what was going on, and that when they find that there's room for cooperation, the religion seems to modify.
Right.
Yeah. Let me go to what you said might be technical, which is this idea of zero sum and non-zero sum. You wrote a whole book about it. It seems to me, and I was almost surprised how often it came up in the new book, The Evolution of God. I mean, it really is something looks pretty central to how you approach things.
Yeah.
Explain it to people.
Okay, there's basically, in game theory, there's two basic kinds of games. A zero-sum game is the kind most of us are familiar with, where there will be a winner and a loser. So you're playing tennis with somebody, and every point is going to be good for one of you, bad for the other. So your fortunes are exactly inversely correlated. That's the key thing. With a non-zero-sum game, there is some degree of correlation in your fortune. So if you're playing doubles, then the person on your side of the net, you're in a completely non-zero-sum relationship with, because every point is either good for both of you or bad for both of you. That's a complete positive correlation of your fortunes. In the real world, you seldom find you seldom find either extreme. I mean, you do find some zero-sum situations, but you rarely find a completely positive correlation in fortunes. But you do find a lot of positive correlations, which is, so for example, the global economy went downhill and a lot of people are suffering around the world. So a globalized economy puts people around the world in a non-zero sum situation because to some extent their fortunes are correlated.
Just for the example, a economic situation that would not be non-zero-sum, that would be zero-sum, would be colonialism, perhaps? Well, not even.
Well, yeah, I mean, economics...
Theft is
non-zero-sum. I mean, see, economics, per se, tends to be non-zero-sum because when there's an economic exchange, both people are under the impression, they may turn out to be wrong, but they're under the impression that they have gained. So when you go to a store,
yeah,
you would rather have the merchandise than the money you're handing over. The merchant would rather have the money than the merchandise.
And the negotiation is about...
Now, in negotiation, things can be zero-sum, right? So if you're at a car dealer and you've decided any price under $20,000 works for you, and the car dealer knows he or she can make money at anything over $19,000, then in between $19,000 and $20,000, that's where the bargaining takes place. That's a totally zero-sum game.
Right. So the purchase of the car is a non-zero-sum game.
That's right. And if
the negotiation about the exact price within each of you's sort of limits,
right,
and goals,
right,
is the zero-sum
part. If you get the dealer from, you know, 19.5 to 19.4, that's entirely the dealer's loss and your gain. So the bargaining is there's a zero-sum range of bargaining, but if the deal falls apart, you both lose, and that's the interesting tension, where you both kind of want to act as if you're willing to bail on the deal, you know, although neither one of you wants it to fall apart. And that's the way, usually in life, there's a combination of zero-sum and non-zero-sum dynamics. I mean, just think of your friends, you know. Sometimes the reason they're friends is because you have some commonality of interest.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some non-zero-sum dynamic.
You both have decided that there's mutual gain.
And it may not be conscious. I mean, the emotions that undergird friendship evolved by natural selection because they were conducive to non-zero-sum interaction. So if you just are talking about something with someone and you don't know them very well, but you find you have a shared interest, baseball, a political cause, you warm up to them a little without necessarily calculating that collaboration with them will be in your interest. That's your emotions designed by natural selection doing the calculating. So there is conscious calculation.
So your behavior
sometimes
and your emotions will shift.
Right.
Even though the gain may be just a temporary enjoyment.
Can be, or it can be some serious kind of collaboration.
Right.
But this is what underlies the dynamic I'm talking about with religions, where you think, you know, these people are not a threat, you can get along with them, you can do business. Without thinking about it, you judge their religion more tolerantly. And that's the key thing to understand, I think. I mean, you know, people, like, they'll look at Hamas or something and they'll say, but they say they'll never accept the existence of Israel or whatever. And that's their stated position now. But I'm just saying human nature makes people's moods and affiliations and relationships more malleable than that. And over time, I mean, ultimately, this is based on a somewhat cynical view of human nature, which is that people, they don't have very fixed principles, actually, you know. If it's in their interest to change their view on certain things, they tend to do it. And the key is to make it in the interests of people to live in peace and to judge one another with kind of leniency and charity. Now, I happen to also think that is leading them toward moral truth when that happens. But I do think the way to lead people to moral truth sometimes is to make it in their interest.
It's through self-interest.
Yeah.
And again, I'm Terry McNally speaking with Robert Wright. We're speaking about the ideas in his book, The Evolution of God. Turns out some of those ideas are also in his earlier book, Non-Zero. And you can learn more at bloggingheads, one word, bloggingheads.tv. Again, in my conversation with Reza, we talked about Hamas and Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm.
Hezbollah has been allowed to actually govern.
Right.
And
right.
in so doing, have moderated
right.
their politics. Hamas, at the moment of the election, I thought, great, if they yeah. have to fix potholes and they've got to, you know, make the trains run, blah, blah. You know, I'm using yeah. a stereotype. But they are more likely to moderate. Yeah. When they were closed out and the Western countries wouldn't allow them to,
right.
there goes an opportunity lost. You agree?
Right. Yeah, to show you how naive I am, when they won the election, I thought, good.
So
we said they could participate, right? Surely we can't turn around now and say you don't get to govern. We were kidding. But that's exactly what we did. And we've seen that things just didn't get better, did they? I mean...
And so it goes to that thing that you're saying, engagement.
Engagement is a non-zero-sum game. You know, I mean, first of all, economic engagement is. That's why the idea of keeping Gaza blockaded until the religious extremists moderate their views is to get the cart before the horse. I mean, the way you moderate people's views is to
make
get
it in
them
their
in a non-zero-sum relationship with you, and then they will have a more favorable attitude. So, yeah, we've, you know, during the Bush years, they had so much kind of backwards. And what you said about Hezbollah, I think, is true. You know, people during the war on Hamas on Gaza not so long ago, people were saying, well, why isn't Hezbollah jumping in? Well, for one thing, they were legitimate political actors, and they had an interest in behaving in a more responsible fashion.
Yeah. Yeah, in Lebanon.
Yeah,
in Lebanon, they were
then part of yep. the political system.
And so, I mean, it's seldom that we get these very clear comparisons like that.
Right.
You know, that we allowed Hezbollah to participate, see what's happened.
Right.
We did not in that case. So that's the non-zero thing that underlies, I think, a lot. So in taking what we've just said about non-zero sum and zero sum, what you say about religions are that it's the engagement that draws them into the non-zero-sum game,
mm-hmm.
and when you can engage in
mm-hmm.
a non-zero-sum game, you are likely to find your each self-interest are likely to move toward finding your common interest.
Right. And like for example, I cover the emergence of monotheism in Israel, and I argue that monotheism shows up later than a lot of believing Christians and Jews would have it. I think it doesn't show up until the exile, the Babylonian exile, in the mid-first millennium BCE. And I think what drove Israel to monotheism was a very zero-sum view of the world. You know, they were a small nation in a bad neighborhood. They got pushed around by nations a lot, especially by the great powers, you know, Egypt, Assyria, and so on. And if you look at the people who were arguing before the exile that they should only worship Yahweh, one thing they were saying is, you know, we shouldn't worship the gods of these other nations. And the prophets who were saying this had a very negative view of interaction with other nations, or the value of interacting with other nations. They were nationalists. And there was some basis for their belief because things hadn't worked out for Israel. But after the exile, Israel, you know, Persia, okay, so they're conquered by the Babylonians. The Israelite elites are sent to Babylon. Then Persia conquers the Babylonians, and now the Israelites are in their custody. Cyrus the Great of Persia sends them back to Israel. Now Israel is in a much more secure environment because it's surrounded by countries that are also part of the Persian Empire. So now it can do business with them, can trade with them, and won't get invaded by them. And I argue that after the exile, first of all, you get much more charitable scriptures with respect to people like Assyrians and Moabites, who before the exile are often depicted unfavorably. And I think in general you get what you could call a more inclusive monotheism. If you look at the kind of theological language, even the terms they're using for God, I think after the exile you see that the monotheism that had emerged in the exile with a really belligerent kind of retributive air especially in parts of Isaiah, so-called second Isaiah, the part of Isaiah that they think was written during the exile, you see really, you know, tremendous amounts of animosity toward the larger world, along with these monotheistic utterances on the part of second Isaiah. But after the exile, I think the monotheism acquires a very different spirit.
A more tolerant.
It's tolerant, and there's also the suggestion in some of the terminology that's favored by post-exilic authors of the scripture that that they're kind of buying into a notion of the Godhead, where different gods in the area are manifestations of a single God. So they're almost drawing other gods, gods that have other names, into a unified divinity. Now, that's pretty speculative, I will say, that part. But it's been argued by people other than me. And I think there's reason, you know, it's plausible. There's this very curious fact about the nomenclature for God. There's this term Elohim that's used to refer to Yahweh, and Elohim is a plural noun. It's the plural of the generic for God, and no one's ever kind of understood that. But some people think, and this, although you see it pre-exilically, it's especially favored by an author that was writing after the exile, and some people think that's a way of saying all the gods of the empire, you know, are kind of...
Of this Persian empire, of which they were part.
After the exile, there is still tremendous animosity toward Egypt and Egyptian gods, because mm-hmm. they're beyond the bounds of the empire.
Uh-huh.
So it's still zero-sum with Egypt.
Very clear, very clear. All of this fits into a bigger picture in which you say, not just in this book, but otherwise, that you do speak of sort of an arrow of history, mm-hmm. a movement, a direction to history, and have a fairly positive outlook on that. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, those are kind of two separate issues. I mean, A, whether there's direction in both biological evolution and human history, and whether that signifies some kind of purpose, okay? That's one, that's an analytical question. And then second...
That's two, right? Is there a direction, and if there's a direction...
Well, you're right, those are two questions
yeah.
right there.
Yeah.
There clearly has been a kind of direction in the sense of growing complexity through biological evolution. That's not to say that all organisms are always getting more complex, but if you go back and at different times ask what is the most complex organism out there, the envelope of complexity tends to rise with time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then in history, there is a growing complexity of human societies through cultural evolution, okay? Since cultural evolution started really moving along 10,000 years ago or so, you get from, you know, hunter-gatherer village to agrarian chiefdom to ancient city-state and so on, and now we're on the verge of globalized organization, okay? So there is direction toward growing complexity. That's hard to deny.
Right.
It's a separate and much more difficult question whether that signifies something you could in some sense call purpose. And first of all, you could mean a lot of things by purpose. You don't necessarily mean some intelligence designed it, and I probably shouldn't get into all the things you could mean. But anyway, that's one question. And then the next question is the purpose on balance a good one? In other words, is the direction tending toward the good? And
mm-hmm.
I don't really have a simple answer to that question. I do think that along certain dimensions, human history has been good. And the main one is, I mean, look, there's a lot of things I personally don't like about technological change. I mean, I think it's characteristic of people who get to my, you know, who are moving through middle life, to start being less and less enchanted with all the new things, you know. I joined Facebook, but, you know, you're less and less comfortable. So anyway, I'm not a technological utopian, but I do think there's one dimension along which human history, broadly speaking, has brought moral progress, and that is the just expansion of kind of the moral compass in the sense of getting people to more and more acknowledge the fundamental humanity of people of different ethnicities and nationalities. I mean, in a hunter-gatherer village, you know, 15,000 years ago, so far as anthropologists and archaeologists can tell, if you were out hunting and you saw somebody you'd never seen before, didn't know where they came from, and there were four of you and one of them, you'd probably kill them. I mean, it would, you know, that seems, you know, hard as that is to believe, tolerance was just not a highly cosmopolitan situation.
Well, as you point out, in the hunter-gatherer village itself...
Yeah. That's a different story.
Because it's so small, everyone knows everybody, everyone's interdependent, morality's high.
Yeah, there can be fierce fighting, and hunter-gatherer village, there can be deaths, and hunter-gatherer villages even divide sometimes over fighting. But by and large, when you have a small group of people and you have to live with them day in and day out, it's a very fairly simple system of kind of moral self-regulation where, you know, you have to be pretty nice to people, or or bad things happen. And that's
right.
why, and that's why, interestingly, I mean, in this book, in The Evolution of God, I note that in hunter-gatherer societies, religion does not have a big moral component. It doesn't have to. The moral system works very simply. You don't need extra incentives to be nice to people.
Right. So there are spirits, and there might be something
religion.
That regulates the sun and the weather and the harvest.
That's absolutely religion.
All those sorts of things. But it doesn't need a moral dimension because mere proximity sort of makes
right.
people be
the
moral.
The moral system doesn't need help. There's no. It's hard to get away with theft. It's just But you do what they do use religion for from the very beginning. Apparently, is to explain why good things happen and why bad things happen, and try to increase the ratio of good to bad. In other words, why do bad things happen? How can we manipulate whatever those forces are so that good things will be more likely to happen? Religion was about that from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And fundamentally about that.
And then, as you say, what I was trying to point out is within the your own place, morality is pretty strong because self-interest
right.
and knowledge kind of serves
right.
it. But strangers are right. a threat.
And then over time, as you say, yes, over the sweep of history, for reasons that I think are intelligible, social organization expands, and that has some bad things. You see more, class differentiation and hierarchies of power grow more pronounced. I'm not saying it's all good, but you do see movement toward a kind of cosmopolitan ethos where in America today, most people, you say, are people of any,
right.
race, creed, or color.
Humans.
And should they get minimal human rights? People say yes and mean it. I mean, they may sometimes honor it in the breach, but it has become a conviction. And I think that one thing, the expansion of the moral compass in that one sense, is kind of built into the direction of history, in the direction
right.
of expanding social organization.
And as you point out, that in those earlier days, someone from another tribe, someone you'd never met before, might not even be considered human.
Oh,
the language.
Well,
the language
suggests that in some cases, certainly they would not be accorded the rights that everyone in your village was taking for granted.
Right, right. Now, let me just ask just to get a perspective on an exception. Many people would point to moral progress by saying, well, we did away with slavery.
Right.
And yet, Kevin Bales, Ben Skinner, a lot of human rights folks would say, not so fast.
Yeah.
There's more slaves, that is, people
yeah.
who have no control over their life or their work, than there ever were. They're valued less than they ever were. How does that fit into this evolution of morality?
Yeah, the explanation is that when there are huge differentials of power, you can get away without acknowledging the significance of someone. I mean, the way basically the expansion of the moral compass has worked is that if you're doing business with people, you have to give them minimal respect. If you're going to do business with the Japanese and buy their cars, you can't go around talking about them the way you talked about them in World War II and treating them as if they were subhuman, okay? So... But that's a case where they have some degree of power, some degree of economic power. They're making something you need. So when there are differentials, huge differentials of power, you don't get the same thing. Now, as it happens, there's pretty much, there are some people in every race, ethnicity, nationality, who have enough power that they merit some degree of respect for these pragmatic reasons. So that has kind of that discourages people from ruling whole ethnicities and whole nationalities out of the kind of realm of humanity. But it's certainly true that individual people, if you let these huge discrepancies of power persist, will be exploited. And modern information technology is in some ways good, I think, in this realm, in that more and more of this stuff is kind of transparent. It's easier to document and make vivid. For example, we know more about what is going on in China, way more than during the Cold War, because China wants to be part of the economy, global economy. So they have to let people have like cell phones and email and stuff. And they do try to crack down on the web, but it's porous enough that, We know more about what's going on there, and I think the Chinese people are getting better at airing their grievances.
Well, I think the other thing we see is that there is at least challenge to this.
Right.
And we recently saw the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen Square,
yeah.
Which is still a secret to many people who live within China.
I guess it is. I mean, the government certainly tries to keep it that way.
Yeah, but I heard some reports.
Yeah.
You know, listen, yes, in fact, it is. But I think what we assume is A, it's challenged. It's both technologically challenged and personally challenged, and that it's moving in the direction, I would think, of becoming harder to do.
I think so. Yeah. And, I mean, the Chinese government is being forced to deal with – I mean, what these it doesn't want to cede power, but when Chinese peasants use cell phones and so on to organize demonstrations and even riots, which they actually do a lot – the government, just for reasons of self-preservation, sometimes tries to address their grievances. There is some of that going on.
Yeah, yeah. You're willing to say that life or existence has a larger or a higher purpose, or that it well might. Now, I can hear many terms there, but what do you mean by each of those terms, and where does religion fit into that for you?
Okay. Well, higher purpose is maybe a misleading term, because I think when people think of higher purpose, they think of some spooky, you know, mystical force reaching down and messing with the system. And I'm not necessarily saying that. I mean, if you look at, you know, deism, which was popular among some of the founding fathers,
right.
There the idea was that there was a God that set up the universe, but it was like clockwork. They just wound up the clock, let it go, and then forever after, it's this material system that just unfolds. The kind of purpose I'm talking about could be something like that. What I am saying is that it has particular kinds of directionality that suggest, though, that there is something surrounding the creation of, in this case, I'm mainly talking about kind of the system of life on Earth, that suggests purpose in some sense. I mean, again, it doesn't need to be some intelligence to set it in motion. For example, let me give you an example.
Well, let me see. One of the things that I often distinguish if I'm talking about religion or God is that animating spirit, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
director, no.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, sort of that,
yeah,
on that continuum.
Or it could be just an algorithm almost that
is unfolding.
For reason we don't totally understand, has built into it. These properties. I don't mean to depart from a purely materialist explanation of natural selection and human history. You don't need to. And this is not understood by a lot of people. I mean, you know, the technical term for purpose in philosophy is teleology. And I think a lot of people don't realize you can have a purely materialist teleology. So, and in a way, an example is an individual organism. In other words, some philosophers are comfortable talking about organisms as having a purpose that's kind of built into them by natural selection. They might put purpose in quotes, but their point is, you know, when an egg starts out, it moves systematically toward certain things, toward maturation. The organism has goals to ingest nutrients and so on. So they would call an organism a purpose of system. And they would say, in that case, it's not like some intelligent creator set it up. It was set up the system of natural selection imbues organisms with purpose. Now, for all I know, if I'm right, and the larger system itself has some purpose, could have been imbued by some, like, meta-natural selection. I don't know. I'm just saying that algorithms like natural selection, I think, don't fall out of trees. There was much more directionality built into it than you would expect if there's not more to its creation than is obvious. I don't. If this sounds too spooky and weird, I'm not expressing myself clearly. Although, look, it could be spooky and weird. I'm not ruling that out either.
Right.
And in fact, I mean, modern science tells you things are spooky and weird. Quantum
physics.
That's
right. No, I know. One of the questions you raise in your book and on your website, by the way, on the website of theevolutionofgod.tv. No, that one's .net.
Evolutionofgod.net.
Evolutionofgod.net. You actually have a few big questions that arise in the book, and you answer them. And one of them is a belief in God
mm-hmm.
any weirder than a belief in electrons?
Right.
And I'll let you
speak
to that.
Yeah, and that's actually that's the afterword of the book, but the whole text of that is online on evolutionofgod.net. And it's an argument, and actually I realized as I was finishing up that it's very much in the spirit of an essay I had read a long time ago by William James called The Will to Believe. So I footnoted it. It's a similar kind of so-called pragmatic in the philosophical sense argument. But anyway, it's the point is, you know, scientists say, yeah, I believe in electrons. Well, okay, it isn't just that they've never seen one. It's that we know from quantum physics that electrons are inconceivable, okay? They have internally contradictory properties. So you say, is it a wave? Is it a particle? And they say, well, both. And you say, what do you mean both? I can't conceive of that. And they go, well,
that's what you mean by conceivable.
Yeah.
Is that the way that we like to think with ethers and ors and things?
Right. I mean,
it doesn't really
fit. You think of it as a particle. Well, that's just not true as a comprehensive ongoing explanation of what an electron is. That doesn't account for all its behavior. And there is no easily conceivable image of it or conception of it that does account for everything electrons do, okay? It is beyond human comprehension. So, in fact, some physicists would say, well, I'm not sure electrons per se really exist. What we know is that it is useful to talk as if electrons existed, okay? You get good scientific results by using that kind of language. And so the question I raise in this is, you know, if thinking of divinity as something that exists leads to good moral results, if it leads people to behave in a morally progressive fashion, or helps them govern their own behavior, is that among the things that might give a kind of validity to a conception of divinity, much the way our belief in electrons is ultimately vindicated by the sheerly practical result
of usefulness,
believing in
its functionality.
Its functionality. I got to say, when I first heard an argument very much like this from William James a long time ago, I thought, that's nuts. And maybe I'm just getting old and soft-headed in thinking that it's not as nuts as I thought.
But it's interesting you went to that term, because I was going to say, is the bottom line in this little piece of this conversation not that, so, this is resolved, you know,
right,
such and such, but that it may not be as nuts as some people
just
think it is.
Just have a little humility. And this is something that also gets me a little about some of the new atheist writing, you know. It's just, we don't know. I mean, and I don't, strictly speaking, understand how people can call themselves atheists. I don't, you know, it seems to me, because if the term means you're sure there's no God, I just don't see how you can be sure of anything in this realm. I mean, I am technically an agnostic, although one with kind of spiritual and religious leanings, but I don't know anything, and I don't know how anyone could say they know there's no God.
On either way. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, if you have a religious experience that, you know, God appears, then I can see how you would be pretty convinced. Strictly speaking, you still don't know it's not an illusion, maybe, but I understand. I would say, in that sense, it's easier for me to understand someone who says they're a religious believer than somebody who says they're an atheist, right? Because the religious believer says, I saw it.
That's right. When I was in high school and would have these debates, as I was going from Catholicism toward agnosticism, or now I'm probably, you know, spiritual but not religious,
right.
I can remember, I mean, it's clear as a bell, the moment when this one friend of mine, Roger Woodbury, in a cafe one night said, I've experienced it. You know, you can't argue me out of it, out of God. I've experienced it.
Right.
What can I say?
Well, you know, I had an amazing experience I did a 1 week meditation retreat.
Silence.
It was 5.5 hours of sitting meditation a day, 5.5 hours of walking meditation. No news from the outside world, no phone calls, no speech. And I mean, that was an amazing experience, not in an especially theistic sense, but I mean, I felt it just moved. You know, the experience is that you're just much more appreciative of other beings in the world. It's much less about you. I mean, I remember having the experience of seeing weeds and thinking, I can't believe I've killed these things. You know, they're beautiful. and I mean, that is really the truth. I mean, weed is a label that's imposed. And the fact is, they are as pretty as, you know, I mean, well, actually,
a daffodil is a scourge of most people's lawns. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the tetra, Buckminster Fuller could do no better, you know?
Right. No, and so I do think, I mean, what this gets at is another thing William James said, which is that our ordinary state of consciousness that we use to get us through life and drive to work is just one possible state of consciousness. And there's no reason to assume that it's any more valid than a lot of other possible states. And I think in some ways it's manifestly less valid, because our ordinary state of consciousness was designed by natural selection to serve our own interests.
And it limits. It's right. mainly and about it is, limiting. It's about
totally
filtering.
It is an illusion.
I mean, it's interesting. As you were quoting William James so much, I said, where have I heard this? Well, I interviewed a science writer, Winifred Gallagher, recently. There's a book called Wrapped, which is about attention. And boy, it's all comes out of William James, but it's the same thing. I mean, you know, attention is mainly about cutting things out so we can function.
Right.
Because there's too much going on.
And not just narrowing your focus, but your whole evaluation of other people becomes subservient to your own goals.
Yeah.
It gets back to what we were talking about. The thing that brings out the best and the worst in religions is when you're in a zero-sum situation with another group of people, you tend to judge their religion uncharitably. And that's, you know, not necessarily what is deserved. It is your evaluations are slaves to your self-interest. And this was really a fundamental insight of Buddhism, you know, way back, that we go around evaluating everything all the time, and the evaluations are not fundamentally valid.
Right, right. They are choices. They are, yeah, they're not
posing.
They're not platonic
serving. Judgmental scheme on reality.
Yeah, yeah. Let me jump. I'm speaking with Robert Wright. He's the author of The Moral Animal, Non-Zero. We're talking about his new book, The Evolution of God. You can learn more about his work, ongoing work, at bloggingheads.tv. Let me ask you a big question. We've probably got about 4 minutes left. And see if you can handle this one. I only say that because I ask it every now and then, and it's like, you know, if you could look, I would say we've got some trends that are looking poorly now, as much as we sort of see this maybe, you know, moral direction to history and so on, but climate change, the end of peak oil, the vastly greater inequities, it seems, than we've seen in a long time, violent confrontations based on tribal, ethnic, religious things and so on. If you could look from 2020, 2025, and look back, did humanity turn things around? And if so, how? What might have happened to move us?
Well, it's in the array of issues you set out is, I think, the hopeful answer, which is that some of those things you laid out are non-zero-sum implications. So climate change is in the interest of people in lots of continents to solve that one. Or overfishing the seas, it's in their interest. Or just keeping the economy on track. There are all kinds of things that make it in the interest of people to cooperate with other people. And so if they pursue those interests rationally, that will tend to subdue the other thing you mentioned, which is conflict among people, conflict among religions. And in my argument, and in the argument in this book, in The Evolution of God, to the extent that we accurately perceive the non-zero-sum relationships, that, for example, if Westerners look at Muslims and realize they're actually in a non-zero-sum relationship, okay, for lots of reasons, including the reason that if Muslims get less and less happy with their place in the world, that's going to foment extremism, be bad for the West. If they get happier, it's good for the West. If we realize we're in a non-zero-sum relationship, we will tend to judge them more charitably. They will tend to judge us more charitably. And I hate to say them and us, because I know there are lots of Muslims in the West, you know, and so on. And the whole idea of a Muslim world is a vast oversimplification. But you take my point that if people accurately see, I mean, or Israelis and Palestinians realize it's just lose-lose to leave this thing unresolved, then you can, assuming there's enough, you can build trust, then that alone can be enough to start building the more charitable view of each other that fosters cooperation.
Well, but that would be what happened.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what's going to be, and I do mean imagine.
Yeah.
Like putting on your science fiction hat.
Yeah, no, I think it takes leaders of vision and inspirational power, and I think Barack Obama is pretty good in that regard. I mean, I was very impressed by the Cairo speech, and, you know, and I remember very early on I said, you know, this guy, I mean, he's well positioned by background. To teach the world that we all have an interest in cooperation. and that the violence is senseless, and that we should come to our senses.
Well,
and
if I were going to say I consider myself a political progressive, when we find fault, myself, my allies find fault with the way he's handling the bailout,
right,
or the way he's handling Afghanistan,
right.
Those are real. I mean, those are real arguments that could be had.
Yeah.
But I look back and I go, you know, he didn't say he was going to do too many of those things,
right,
specifically. What he said was he was going to change the way we govern. He was going to change the way we deal with each,
yeah,
other. He basically argued for non-zero sum.
Yeah.
More than he argued for any one policy.
I think he does. And I think he's been more pragmatic on some political fronts than I would like. But I'm impressed that in some areas, I think he's kind of stuck to his guns. On Israel-Palestine, I've been impressed. I think for domestic political purposes, it would have been easier for him to not insist that the settlements completely
stop. To go
along
with everyone else.
I've been a little despondent over some of his compromises, but in that realm, you know, look, anybody's got to pick their fights.
Yeah.
You can't be picking a fight on every front at all times. And I do think, to the extent that he's focusing on these global issues of international and trans-ethnic and trans-religious cooperation, it may be that that is where he should put his chips. And that's where his assets can best be deployed.
Okay. I'm gonna let it go at that. So again, Robert Wright's newest book is The Evolution of God. And there's a couple of websites worth looking at. One is evolutionofgod.net, which is about the book and includes a lot of excerpts. Really, you can go in a lot of depth on the site. And then Blogging Heads TV, which is a site he edits in which there are conversations of all sorts of people, about 5 or 10 a week. That's bloggingheads.tv. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast, and you can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. So for podcasts, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, email me at temcnally@mac.com. T-E-McNally, one word, @mac.com. And also you can sign up for a weekly announcement that'll tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and a little more than that. And thank you, Robert Wright. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.